Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. This is Rini at Rini's Heart to Heart. Thanks for tuning in. I did some more research today, and on a topic that I have a lot of concern about, and now even more so, because the more I delve into these things, the more I realize how truly large some of these problems are. What I'd like to talk about tonight is addiction to prescription drugs. And surprisingly, or not so surprisingly, I don't know, I guess it depends on how much you know about this, it's really quite awful what has happened in the last 10 years in regard to prescription drugs. I found lots of websites. I found lots of websites for treatment for addiction to opiates in particular, oxycodones, fentanyl, anything that makes you kind of oblivious to the pain that you may be enduring or think you're enduring or whatever the case might be. Sadly, that's what makes it so awful. I guess for a long time, all over, not just here in Florida, but all over the world, including other countries, pill mills popped up. And for those of you who don't know what a pill mill is someplace where you can go in and with the right amount of money, you can get a prescription for just about anything you want, whether you need it or not. Hence the problem. Young people were utilizing this opportunity to, get high and put themselves in a place where they were more comfortable. Every day in the U.S., there's 2,500 youth ages 12 to 17 who abuse a prescription pain reliever for the first time. Prescription drug use, while most prevalent in the U.S., is a problem in many areas around the world, including Europe, Southern Africa, South Asia. In the U.S. alone, more than 15 million people abuse prescription drugs. More than the combined, now listen to this, everybody, because you're not going to believe it. More than 15 million people abuse prescription drugs. More than the combined number who reported abusing cocaine, hallucinogens, inhalants, and heroin. In 2006, in the United States, 2.6 million people abused prescription drugs for the first time. In 2007, a survey in the U.S. found that 3.3% of 12 to 17-year-olds, 6% of 17 to 25-year-olds had abused prescription drugs in the past month. These sound like a small amount, but 3% of 12 to 17-year-olds in the U.S. is a large number. Prescription drug abuse causes the largest percentage of deaths from drug overdosing. Now, I'm sure nobody even imagined that. I'm sure that nobody ever gave any thought to the fact that people were killing themselves with something that was designed by our amazing scientists and biologists and chemists to bring relief. But it's true. Of the 22,400 drug overdose deaths in the U.S. in 2005, opiate painkillers were the most commonly found drug, accounting for 38% of these deaths. In 2005, 4.4 million teenagers aged 12 to 17 in the U.S. admitted to taking prescription painkillers, and 2.3 million took a prescription stimulant such as Ritalin. In a lot of cases, Ritalin is given to young kids. 2.2 million abused over-the-counter drugs such as cough syrup. And an average age for first-time users is now 13 to 14. Depressants, opiates, and antidepressants are responsible for more overdose deaths, 45%, than cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, and amphetamines combined. I know this is shocking. In the United States, the most deaths used to take place in inner cities, in African-American neighborhoods, but they have now been overtaken by white rural communities. The same trend can be seen in the rates of hospitalization for substance abuse and emergency hospitalization for overdoses. Of the 1.4 million drug-related emergency room admissions in 2005, almost 600,000 were associated with abuse of pharmaceuticals alone or with other drugs. By a survey, almost 50% of the teens believe that prescription drugs are much safer than illegal street drugs. 60 to 70% say that they get them from their own home medicine cabinets. And according to the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University, teens who abuse prescription drugs are twice as likely to use alcohol, five times as likely to use marijuana. Well, let's face it. If they're using the prescription drugs, we all understand, I think we all understand, that once we use something that alters the way we think, we're in trouble. It takes away, for lack of a better term, our good sense. So ecstasy, cocaine, and all the other things that we hear about all the time are often a part of what they use once they have become impaired with the prescription drugs. In 2007, the Drug Enforcement Administration found that the abuse of the painkiller fentanyl killed more than 1,000 people that year in the U.S. It's 30 to 50 times more powerful than heroin. Fentanyl, for those who don't know, is a drug that was designed to help cancer patients that are in such extreme pain that in some cases the pain kills them. Their heart gives out because they're in such great pain. So fentanyl is incredibly, incredibly strong. You know, the kind of cancers where the cancer is actually eating away at your body, that's what they designed fentanyl for. There's I ran across a lot of stories from people, young people, older people, talking about their descent into this very deep pit, and a lot of them, you know, struggle for the rest of their lives. Drugs are essentially poison, and the amount taken determines the effect. A small amount acts as a stimulant, you know, gives you a little bit of energy and speeds you up. A greater amount acts as a sedative and kind of like takes the edge off and calms you down and then slows you down. An even larger amount poisons you and can kill you. This is true of almost any drug that's out there. Only the amount needed to achieve the effect is what makes the difference. But many drugs have another liability. They directly affect the mind. I really want everybody to hear this because I have argued with so many teenagers in my lifetime and so many young adults because they don't get this. They can distort the user's perception of what is happening around him or her. As a result, the person's actions may be odd, irrational, inappropriate, and even destructive. Drugs block off all sensations, the desirable ones along with the unwanted. So while providing a short-term answer to your pain, if you truly have any, they also wipe out the ability and the alertness and muddy the way you think about things. Medicines are drugs that are intended to speed up or slow down or change something about the way your body is working. I think everybody gets that. To try to make it work better. Sometimes they're necessary. But they are still drugs. They act as stimulants or sedatives, and too much can kill you. So if you do not use medicines the way they are supposed to be used, they can be as dangerous as crack cocaine. People take drugs because they want to change something in their lives. This was a survey taken from young people, and this was some of the reasons young people gave for taking drugs. And it just shows you what an insignificant thing that they think taking the drug is. Number one was to fit in. Number two was to escape or relax. Number three was to relieve boredom. To seem grown up, to rebel, to experiment. They think drugs are a solution, but eventually drugs become the problem. As difficult as it may be to face one's problems, the consequences of drug use are always worse than the problem one is trying to solve with them. Amen. The real answer is to get the facts and not to take drugs in the first place. These pages that I found on the internet, there's an opportunity on this particular site. I looked up addiction to prescription drugs and facts, and it's a website called The Truth About Prescription Drug Abuse. And if you get on this site and tell them you want these pamphlets, they will send you these pamphlets for free. And it's an information kit for educators. If you're a teacher and you think it's a good idea to talk to the students, or even maybe have some extra classes that will reinforce the truth versus the daydream about the romantics of being able to get high and have everything look more beautiful and seem more gentle and more wonderful. Please, that's not true. It just isn't true. While the use of many street drugs is on a slight decline in the United States, abuse of prescription drugs is growing. In 2007, 2.5 million Americans abused prescription drugs. And compared to the 2.1 million who started using marijuana. Among teens, prescription drugs are the most commonly used drugs next to marijuana. And almost half of the teens abusing prescription drugs are taking painkillers. Oxycodone is, I guess, one of the most popular, if I can use that word without making myself sick to my stomach, but it is apparently. And there's a lot of different ways that young people get them into their system. Prescription painkillers are powerful drugs that interfere with the nervous system's transmission of the nerve signals we perceive as pain. Most painkillers also stimulate portions of the brain associated with pleasure. Thus, in addition to blocking pain, they produce a high. And this, of course, is what makes them desirable for anybody, that's unhappy. The most powerful prescription painkillers are called opiates, which are opium-like compounds. They're manufactured to react on the nervous system in the same way as drugs derived from the opium poppy, like heroin. The most commonly abused opiate painkillers include oxycodone, hydrocodone, meperidine, hydromorphone, and propoxyphene. Oxycodone has the greatest potential for abuse and the greatest dangers. It is as powerful as heroin and affects the nervous system the same way. Oxycodone is sold under many trade names such as Percodan, Endodan, Roxyprin, Percocet, Endocet, Roxyset, and OxyContin. It comes in tablet form. Hydrocodone is used in combination with other chemicals and is available in prescription pain medication as tablets, capsules, and syrups. Trade names include Anexia, Dicodid, Hycodan, Hycomine, Loracet, Lortab, Norco, Tushinex, and Vicodin. Now, see, I once hurt my back very bad that lasted me a couple years before I had back surgery, and I'm going to tell the truth. I was in my 30s, and as I've mentioned before on the show, I've always been a very big woman, and I've always worked very hard, and the back pain was excruciating for me. And most of the time I got by with Excedrin, but when it got real bad, so that it hurt me to walk and even function, they put me on things like Vicodin and Percocet and things like that. I had no idea until I read this article that they're all in the same family with the oxycodone and heroin, actually. So I'm taking these when I'm a kid and working 50 hours a week and taking care of a family of six. And I laughed about this with some friends the other day about thinking I was in charge and functioning at a decent level for somebody who needed some serious back surgery. And I remember I sent my mortgage payment to FP&L and my FP&L check to my mortgage company. And, you know, got them back in the mail, and I was like, who did this? Why did this happen? How could this have happened? And I realized it was me. So good lesson for me, because after that happened, the strongest thing I will ever take is an Excedrin or what's the other one that everybody takes all the time, Aleve or something like that. I don't take anything stronger because obviously my body's not good with it. The other really strong one that's used a lot is Demerol and Dilaudid. Now, Dilaudid, I know, has been around for many, many years. That's what they would give to people years and years and years ago. After surgeries and things like that, they'd give them Dilaudid, and it usually came in a syrup form. But the Demerol, the Hydromorphone, and which is the Dilaudid, and Darvon in capsules, but all three have been known to be crushed and injected, snorted, or smoked. Darvon, banned in the UK since 2005, is among the top 10 drugs reported in drug abuse deaths in the U.S. Dilaudid, considered 8 times more potent than morphine, is often called drugstore heroin on the streets. So I guess the biggest point I'm trying to make with everybody is there's a lot of choices out there, and there's a lot of things that young people and not so young people can get involved in. And one more little section of what can actually occur after this is used for any length of time, I think you should know about. Opiate painkillers produce a short-lived euphoria, but they're also addictive. Well, we get that. Long-term use of painkillers can lead to physical dependence. The body adapts to the presence of the substance, and if one stops taking the drug abruptly, withdrawal symptoms occur. Or the body could build up a tolerance to the drug, meaning that higher doses have to be taken to achieve the same effects. Like all drugs, painkillers simply mask the pain for which they are taken. They do not cure anything. Now, let me say about this. If you're taking these kind of pills because you have a bad back, what do you suppose happens when you take a real heavy dose of these pills and you know you have a bad back, you know you probably need surgery, you know something is wrong in your spine? How big a chance are you taking, first of all, with taking the drug? Second of all, with what, while you're under the influence of something that's hiding a lot of it, how much more are you hurting yourself? How many more things can you do to yourself until it can't be fixed? I think that that needs to be taken into consideration, because if you mask something or hide something or disguise something, you forget it's there. And then even if you're taking them to go to work and it makes you sound like a real soldier and somebody who's really doing the best that they can to support and take care of families and what have you, but in the meantime, you may never walk again. You have to think of these things. Like all drugs, painkillers simply mask the pain for which they are taken. They don't cure anything, the longer you take it, the more you need, the higher the dosage you need, everything. And you'll get to a point where you cannot make it through a day without the drug. And then symptoms of withdrawal are horrible. I know firsthand that withdrawal from oxycodone many, many times hospitalizes people. Restlessness, muscle and bone pain, insomnia, diarrhea, vomiting, cold flashes, goosebumps, involuntary leg movements. One of the serious risks of opiates is respiratory depression. High doses can cause breathing to slow down to the point that it stops and the user dies. So, again, I want everybody to understand the seriousness of this. And one of the reasons I wanted to explain all the drugs is because I wanted to make a point about the pill mills. And for those of you who don't know what a pill mill is, again, it's a doctor's office where anyone can go in and get a prescription to fill at their nearest drugstore for an opiate or a painkiller, whatever it is their choice to have. And I guess 10 years ago is when they started growing and springing up all over the United States. And in about 2005, after it had been going very strongly, there was a mass shutdown of the pill mills. And they really struggled to gain control of it, because they would pop up everywhere in little strip malls, in little places, and people would find them. I know for a fact, I've been in Mexico, and in Mexico, people in white jackets approach you on the street. And so now the problem is, because they're shutting down most of the pill mills, guess what's back in town? It ain't Lola. It's heroin, and heroin is on the rise again, in particular here in the state of Florida, and which is scary as well. So I think we need to look into this. This coincides with some of the other stuff that we talk about, because you realize that everything all is attached to each other. Everything that we do, all the things, that stuff we talked about last night with the IRS and the frustrations that happen to people and the fact that so many people can't pay their bills and so many people lose their homes, very sadly, we turn to the quick fix, the make me feel better right this minute, the instant gratification, and this is where you end up. I think it's a terrible thing. It makes me sad to know that, again, people that we hold in high regard, such as doctors and nurses and physicians, are participating in this for the money, obviously for the money. So it's a sad state of affairs, to say the least. I do think everybody should be aware of it, and I do think everybody should understand that it is totally illegal to go to a pill mill and get a prescription when you really don't need something like that. And one of the other things that has kind of been derived from this mess with the pill mills and the prescription street drugs is the fact that now they have a lot of pain management clinics. And when I researched that, I see that many of them promise to get you off of the opiates and off of any of the hard drugs, including things like antidepressants, which I didn't talk about too much, things like Xanax and some of the other things that even the Ritalin and things like that that they give to young people who have been diagnosed with ADHD and things like that. Once you take something that changes your makeup, your connectivity, all of those things, you will always need something to replace that when you take it away, unless you go through some real serious detox and some real serious readjusting of your mindset and who you are. Just like alcoholism, just like anything that we know that becomes a really bad habit, smoking. The only thing I can see that about smoking, when somebody quits smoking, they often put on a few pounds because they replace it with sugar and things like that. The same with alcoholism. Drugs, I guess, have the same effect, but hard drugs like what we're talking about here have much longer lasting effects. So I think it's a good idea if everybody's aware of that, especially you that are parents, especially you that might suspect your child or maybe you are addicted in some way to some of these things. Maybe it's time for you to examine what's going on in your life and your own personal behavior. And if you do have these drugs and you're managing them all right and you're really in a place where you need them, please don't just keep them where anybody can reach them. Because as I said, most of the teenagers that were interviewed got them from mom's and dad's medicine cabinet. So I'm going to open up the lines and bring in Shelley. Hi, Shell.
Hi, Reedy.
How are you?
Doing good. I had a little problem calling into the show tonight. I kept getting a busy signal, believe it or not, for about 10 minutes.
I wonder why.
I don't know at which end of the phone it was, but because I kept saying, it wouldn't even ring. It would go right into a busy signal, but it was, so that's why I'm late. Sorry. I caught what the show was about. I don't know if you realized at what point I got in there, but I realized what you're talking about.
Okay.
And of course, the interesting thing about all the different subjects that we talk about on this show, because if somebody were to just kind of like check in, a day here and a day there, you know, a week apart or something, it always sounds like we talk about so many broad subjects, but they all are interrelated. Because how we treat each other, how we treat ourselves, what we think of other people, what we think of ourselves, our conduct, our decisions, our thoughts, they all map out how we feel emotionally, which affects us physically, and then it gets us to health, and it gets us to self-medicating, because if you're in pain physically or if you're in pain emotionally, then that makes you either make bad decisions, it can make you treat people unkind, or it can make you turn to self-medicating to just have some level of either comfort or happiness in short spurts. And, you know, it gives people a sense of control over their life, but unfortunately what it really does is rob the control from them, because instead of them being in control over their moods end up controlling them, and they need, like you said, they need more and more of the drug or whatever it is to just, at some point, just to feel normal again. Not even to get that high. So it is interesting that we talk about so many different subjects, but they really are all interrelated, on many levels. So it's interesting.
Well, I think when we talk about being rude to each other, unkind to each other, unforgiving with each other, I see when I live this life of mine,
that sometimes that poor behavior doesn't come from us naturally. It's being induced by our lifestyle.
Oh yeah, absolutely, I agree with that.
Right.
You know,
so,
you and I have talked about this many times. You know, I don't do drugs either. I never did. I don't even like taking painkillers. I can't take prescription drugs. I haven't been able to take prescription drugs. Well, I choose not to now, but I lost the ability to take antibiotics over 20 years ago because I became fatally allergic to many of them, where I would actually go into convulsions if I tried to take antibiotics. And I couldn't take prescription painkillers for the same reason, because my body overreacted to them. And I would actually pass out if I took. I had back surgery also many, many years ago. I mean, it's like 30 years ago. Not anything like yours. This was surface. I had a tumor on the edge of my spine, but it wasn't mm-hmm. On my spinal cord. And so it was a fairly invasive surgery, but nothing compared to what you went through. But at any rate, so they gave me Demerol. I ended up passing out from the Demerol, and then they went to Percocet. I passed out from the Percocet. I ended up having to stay on, I think it was Tylenol 3, which had codeine in it or something, and that just took the edge off, and I was able to tolerate that. But other than that, and like I said, that was 30 years ago, I can't take painkillers, I can't take antibiotics, and now I'm glad I can't because I choose not to take prescription meds. But about 4 or 5 years ago, I don't know if you remember, I wrenched my neck, and I couldn't move either one of my arms, and I actually locked my shoulders.
I remember.
You sent Michael to come and get me and take me to the hospital because I couldn't lift either one of my arms. I could drive.
Yeah.
And the doctor at the hospital was shocked because he said he never saw muscles that rigid. He said they felt like metal to him. That was the time he gave me. So they wanted to give me a shot in my muscles, which I wouldn't let them because it was Celebrex. So I wouldn't let them give me that because there's all kinds of side effects to that. But I did let them give me Valium. And, you know, again, I know I don't take drugs or anything, but this was the type of Valium they used to relax the muscles. And what shocked me is that I think I took one or two, and after the second one, it relaxed the muscles enough where I could finally turn my head and start lifting my arms. This was like 12 hours later, okay? And he told me to keep taking the Valiums. I think he wanted me on them for 3 or 4 days, okay? Well, by the third or fourth Valium, I swear to God, we're talking like 4 doses later, I was so depressed. And you know me, I'm angry sometimes, but I'm never depressed,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Right,
I was so depressed that I actually felt suicidal. I was stunned. First time in my life ever felt that. Now, for people listening that don't know me, that is so far a stretch for my personality. And it shocked me. Thank God I'm one of these people. I'm very analytical. So I realized that it wasn't normal for me, so I didn't buy into it. But how many people take these drugs and already have some sort of depressive disorder or something like that, and then they take this medication and it intensifies it, you know, and then you wonder why people commit suicide on these drugs. You know, in my particular case, I knew it was artificial. I knew that if I stopped taking the drugs, that the feeling would go away, so
mm-hmm.
I didn't overreact to it, but I was very much aware of it. I felt despondent. I felt hopeless. But like I said, because I'm analytical, I was able to step back from these emotions and realize they weren't mine, you know. But that takes a real heightened level of self-awareness to be able to go there, and I think probably 99% of the people that would take medication like that and have that reaction would not go there and would think that their life was hopeless and that something was going terribly wrong and react to it, where I didn't react to it. I realized it was artificial.
Well, I think if more people did, then it wouldn't become such a habit. I think
right.
If there were more people that had the side effects like what happened to you,
mm-hmm.
we would probably save more people in the long run. But very sadly, most of them appreciate that feeling of not just euphoria, it's not so much about that from everything I've read. It's more like a well, first of all, it's pain-free in the beginning and
mm-hmm.
easy to achieve pain-free. And
mm-hmm.
and pain, of course, is another one of those things that has to be interpreted by the owner of the pain. So,
mm-hmm.
like, what's pain for you may be not so pain for me or vice versa. And a lot of times the pain doesn't have anything to do with anything physical. So a lot of times people take drugs like these prescription drugs, because they just think that they don't feel good. I mean, I have talked in my lifetime to, I'm going to say in the hundreds of people who were addicted to either alcohol or some kind of drug, and they always said the same thing. I just get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I'm like, and now do you feel better? Well, sometimes. And before, I'd never felt all right. And I'm like,
right.
So it all depends on what you're willing to accept too, I guess. But like I said, because all this snowballs together, and because, I mean, the first thing anybody said to me that found out what happened to Mike, everybody said to me, what were those kids on?
Wow.
You know, and they weren't on anything, for those who don't know that. They were straight. But that was the first reaction that everybody had. So that feeling of well-being is commonly known to change to be something that is neurotic and can be, you know, harmful to other people if you're abusing
right.
these particular kinds of drugs. And then, of course, we have the very, very sad case of Michael Jackson. And
yeah.
It's funny how many times Michael Jackson comes up on this show. Because
yeah.
for some reason, he's kind of like... I mean, yes, Elvis Presley was addicted to drugs, and but Elvis Presley, it was different. I think Michael Jackson, he felt that for his public, he had to be different.
Well,
he had to be.
Did you know how he got addicted to drugs to begin with? Did you ever hear that whole background on why he started taking the drugs in the first place?
Well, I thought it had something to do with him when he worked so hard to be the dancer. I thought he hurt himself or something, and
well,
something
yeah,
happened
but
to him there.
Do you remember the? It was either a Coke or a Pepsi. It was one of the soda commercials. I don't
oh,
remember
yes, it caught on
was.
Fire on his head. That's
right,
right. Coke.
What happened, right, and it burned so intensely because of the product he had in his hair that it actually burned down and scorched the scalp. They said he was in intense pain. To the point where he couldn't handle it. So they gave him drugs, and just like it happened to a lot of people that start taking drugs just to kill the pain, they're highly, highly addictive. And he ended up becoming addicted to them. And that's why his doctor got in so much trouble. Instead of weaning him off when he didn't need him anymore, he just kept Michael on them because he was easier to control while he was on the drugs. But he ended up getting insomnia and all these other conditions that he didn't have before the accident with the commercial. That commercial sent him into a downward spiral that is just tragic if you look back on it, you know, because he was handling everything else up to that point. And then with the whole lawsuit and all that, and then his life almost started decompiling. And then he took the drugs because he was already used to using them, for the emotional pain, but it started from physical pain. And that's where it starts with a lot of people. They start with it because of back surgery or because of an accident or because of this or because of that. And then they end up finding that it masks a lot of their emotional pains also. And it ends up really complicating their lives if they go that route.
Well, that's,
you know, that's
for sure.
Yeah.
Because everything changes then. Everything.
Mm-hmm. That's
you
right.
know, their tolerance for pain, for one thing, they no longer can tolerate anything.
And all types of pain. They can't tolerate physical or emotional pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the thing about it.
Right. They also get very paranoid and
think
that, you know, which causes a very deep-seated anger and an inability to deal with everything on a daily basis because they think that everybody's out to get them.
Well, you know, what I had read, which I found that was very interesting, is that a lot of these painkillers actually cause what's called rebound pain in the body. So let's say that your body is healing and you're taking these painkillers. What you're supposed to do is wean down off of them. If they were used properly, people wouldn't get addicted to them. What's supposed to happen is you're supposed to wean down pretty aggressively because as the body's healing, you need less and less and less and less. But what happens is that's not how these prescriptions work, okay? So what happens is as the body's healing and you're taking the same dose, now you're starting to flip to an addictive mode. And what happens is the use of the prescription drug actually causes what are called phantom pain. So you'll start feeling pain that has nothing to do with the injury anymore. It's actually coming from using the drug. And if people could just get themselves to stop using it and go through whatever withdrawal they went through, they would find, because I've spoken to a couple of people who have done this after I'd read the article, and there were all these like testimonials and stuff of people that just got so fed up with how they felt on the painkillers, they stopped. And within 4 to 5 days, usually takes to go through, and it's like really a rough withdrawal. But then once they come through it, there's no physical pain anymore. The pain was actually being caused as a rebound effect of the drug itself, no longer from the physical injuries. Is that interesting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and you know, one of the other things that I read tonight that's along those lines that I wanted to chat before I read it, but it is about the OxyContin, and they call it hillbilly heroin, and that's the problem with it. Let me read this real quick because this is a good article. Because it reacts on the nervous system like heroin or opium, some abusers are using one brand of oxycodone painkiller, OxyContin, as a substitute for or supplement to street opiates like heroin. Armed robberies of pharmacies have occurred where the robber demanded only OxyContin, not cash. In some areas, particularly the eastern United States, OxyContin has been the drug of greatest concern to law enforcement authorities. OxyContin, widely known as hillbilly heroin because of its abuse in Appalachian communities, has emerged as a major crime problem in the U.S. In one county, it was estimated that addiction to this drug was behind 80% of the crime.
Oh, my God.
So,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of scary. And then this guy writes a personal note. I didn't think I had a drug problem. I was buying the tablets at my drugstore. It didn't affect my work. I would feel a bit tired in the mornings, but nothing more. The fact that I had a problem came to a head when I took an overdose of about 40 tablets and found myself in the hospital. I spent 12 weeks in the clinic conquering my addiction. But you see,
oh my gosh.
That's the deal, though. You see, that's the deal, because it's really so dangerous because it fools you into believing that you're better. It's very much like an alcoholic. An alcoholic, when he reaches a certain stage of being intoxicated, thinks that everybody loves them, that they're the life of the party.
Right, and they think that when they're not drunk, that they're dull and boring, and meanwhile, it's actually the opposite. People love them when they're sober because they're clear-headed. You can have conversation with them. You can actually tap into their intellect. You know, a lot of people that have addictive problems are actually very intelligent. My oldest, you've heard me talk of Sue before. I had a friend of mine. We were very dear friends for 12 years, and the first 6 years she was clean, and I didn't know that she had had a history with drug abuse, but she, like we talked on this show, she had a traumatic event when she was a teenager. Her parents didn't deal with it properly. They didn't help her through it, and she started self-medicating, got in with about crowd, ended up turning to drugs, went from a straight-A student to almost dropping out. And here was a woman who had an extremely high IQ, very, very smart, very ethical, but she couldn't handle the pain of this tragedy that that happened to her. A close friend of hers died in a car accident. She was in the car. As it was something, mm-hmm. it's a condition called survivor's guilt. She couldn't deal with the fact that she survived it, best friend did. So anyway, so as time went on, she just got really messed up from it. But when I met her, she had been clean for many, many years. Started having problems at job and went back on the drugs. So I started over a six-year period of time, the second half of our friendship, I watched this amazingly intelligent woman who was extremely ethical when I met her, very hardworking, brilliant in many things. She was my mentor. She was one of the people that taught me a lot of what I learned as far as the technicality of what I do with my job. And I actually watched her completely disintegrate her personality.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just, by the end of our friendship, there was literally no remnant of the person that I had become friends with. And she just de-evolved and de-evolved and de-evolved. And by the end, I couldn't even recognize the original person anymore. And she wasn't even getting high to get life uplifted. Near the end, which is what we were talking about a few minutes ago, and near the end, she was getting high just to feel normal.
Yeah.
Just to get out of the depths of depression where she wanted to commit suicide. She became very suicidal near the end. She talked about it all the time. And then she'd get high, and she'd be artificially euphoric and giddy. And that was her two levels of existence. She was either high, or she was so depressed that she wanted to commit suicide. And it was just terrible to watch it, you know.
Well, and that's, of course, that's the other thing. That's the... that's why they use methadone and things like that, because it's all about it's all about bringing somebody back, you know, gently. And I think that sometimes that's really not the answer, because what really happens is all you do is placate somebody. And I'm almost of the mindset, and I could be wrong, I'm not a doctor, and I've never had to do this for myself, and that's usually the best way to know if something really works, is if you do it yourself. I think that if you don't do something like this and just do it, it's not that easy to handle. You just become addicted to something else. And, you know, you climb up a ladder from the very bottom, from one addiction to the other, maybe a little less addicted or a little less harmful until you get up there. And then by that time, sometimes your body won't work for you anymore. So some of these places that... I've talked with a lot of people, and, of course, you know, at Hippocrates, we didn't deal with somebody who was trying to come off of drugs or alcohol, but many times they'd come to us after the fact. And I would sit and listen to their stories, and I have some in my own family. My father was an alcoholic, and he'd dry himself out many times. And in my life as a child, I remember watching him try to get sober. I remember going to hospitals to see adult friends of mine who had been closet alcoholics, and all of a sudden they would get sick and weren't able to get to the booze, and all of a sudden they'd be like having DTs and convulsions and all those kind of things. And everybody would find out that they were, you know, all these years drinking straight booze, but because nobody knew them any other way, they thought that was the normal behavior for them. So I think drugs can be that way as well. I certainly know marijuana can. But I also think that the more you hide about the needs of your own personal self, your own body, your own makeup, your own skill sets, then you get confused. and so does your body. And pretty soon you can't function on any level because you no longer know what you can do and what you can't do.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, you know what's interesting? Do you remember I had told you I had done a course many, many months ago on addictionology, which is a new level of it's like a new way of dealing with people that have addiction. They use a little bit of the 12 steps, but not really, because they don't like the 12 steps, because the first part of the 12 steps is you have to say out loud that you're powerless. And they think that that's completely wrong, that what the addictionologist will say is that you are powerless in your life while you're using drugs. But when you're clean, you have complete power over your life. So they teach them that they're only powerless when they're using drugs. They're not powerless against their addiction. They can overcome their addiction with the right understanding of where the addiction comes from. So I like the premise right there. They also don't believe in methadone, which is what we were just talking about, because they say you're basically just replacing one drug with another, and that's kind of nonsensical, and then the person gets addicted to methadone. They've had people on methadone for 30 years. Then they can function better, but it's still a drug and it's still doing some stuff to their bodies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they go into what's called amino acid therapy, which is replacing the amino acids that get depleted and prevent the person from feeling okay. So it's very interesting. But what I thought, and if you want, you and I can talk about this more, but I'm putting it out there right now, I might be able to get in touch with the people who run these IOPs. It's called intensive outpatient clinics, and it's actually not a residential program, and they're very effective. They have above 80% success rate in getting people to gain control of their lives, and I'm wondering if they would be willing to talk on the show one night. I can try to approach two of them that I had that are local here to Florida.
That would be great, because I think there's a lot of people out there, you know, there's a lot of us that suffer in silence, and we don't think about asking for help unless somebody puts it out there. So I would love to be able to put something like that out there and see if there's somebody who takes our hand. I think that would be great.
Yeah,
I also, like I said tonight, I wanted to make people aware of the pill mills, the doctors that are doing things illegally. You know, don't support these people. How would you feel if one of the people standing in line with you in one of these pill mills was your kid or your sister or your brother? Because I know people who get hooked on drugs don't want anybody else to get hooked on them. You know, I mean, smoking weed is a party thing. But some of these other drugs that we're talking about, there's nothing partying about it. It's a very lonesome kind of a road. And if you're supporting those places, you're doing a disservice not only to yourself, but so many other people. And like I said, now that they've gotten most of those under some semblance of control, apparently, the old street heroin is back because there's still people in search of that particular high. So, and again, this is all because of, in many cases, the unkindnesses of our world. And that's really what we have to get the biggest handle on. We have to do something that makes our world more pleasant and more, embraces us more, makes us feel more welcome and more a part of. And we can all do that if we do it together. So, and, you know, addictions are in every shape and form. I've had people tell me, you don't understand. And I say, like hell I don't. I'm addicted to food. And they laugh at me when I say that. And I say, don't laugh. I'm not saying it to be funny. And it's not just because food puts weight on you. It's not about me being fat. It's about me taking comfort from eating food.
That's right. That's right.
That's an addiction. That's a serious addiction. because it's one of those kind of addictions that you can't cut cold turkey, if you'll forgive the pun. So, you have to eat. So it's about controlling what you eat, and that's harder than controlling what drug you take.
Right.
So it is a big addiction, and there's a lot of other people out there that have the same addiction I have, and I know that. And some days I feel like I need to get it under control, and some days I feel like, well, who gives a shit? So, and I know that's the way people that are under the influence of drugs feel, or alcohol. I know that because of my addiction to food.
Right. Well, people look at different types of addiction differently, too. They look at drugs and alcohol one way, and they look at gambling another way, and they look at food addictions or sex addictions another. It's almost like they look at them like some of them are almost acceptable and some of them aren't, which is like an addiction is an addiction. I mean, if somebody has an addiction, it's because there's something that they're trying to make good in their life, something that they feel they can control, and then that thing ends up controlling them. They feel good in the beginning, and then it kind of backfires, you know.
Right.
But
right.
You know what's funny with me is that, and I don't know if other people would appreciate this or go there, but one of the main reasons that I never really ever tried drugs, and I used to say this to my friends sometime, and they would say that I thought too much. I'm one of these people, I can't help connecting the dots. And the main reason I never tried recreational drugs is because they were tied to organized crime. And organized crime is tied to just violence, violent murders, killing of cops, child pornography. I don't know how many people realize that organized crime is heavily, heavily behind child pornography. That fact alone made me not want to do recreational drugs, because I didn't want to be passively supporting that industry. And you know, I'm wondering if people really have a thought about that, if it would prevent them. But see, most people don't connect. People don't connect what they do over here to some atrocity happening over there that they think is horrible. You know, it's like so porn or about, you know, things like that in the paper, and they're appalled by it, and then they're going out that weekend and they're buying cocaine. It's like, well, you know, don't you realize that you're part of that? But they don't. They don't see how they're acting.
Yeah, but I don't think a true addiction allows you to see that clearly, honey. I don't think a true addiction. The word addiction in itself.
No, I'm just saying, it prevented me from ever going there to begin with. I never even
tried. I understand.
You can't get addicted if you don't try it.
I understand. But you're saying, isn't it a shame that more people don't get the connection? And once they've become addicted, They could never make the connection, because their addiction, puts some blinders on them.
But I do think that's
a good point to bring out to young people, for sure.
I think that's what I'm talking about, right.
Yeah, that's a very valid point to give to young people when you're talking to them about, you know, the reasons, the obvious reasons are your own personal health and your own personal welfare and, you know, who you become as an adult. But I do think that they're, especially young people who have high ideals about what the world can do for them and what they can do for the world. And there's a lot of those young people out there. So I do think that's a good thing to tell the young people. So tomorrow night I'm going to have a guest. He's going to talk about some of the books he's written. He was supposed to be with us last week, but he was unable to. He and I misunderstood each other about what nights he had off and things like that. So he's going to be with us tomorrow evening, and I hope everybody will enjoy that. And I think that this was a good topic and something that needed to be said. And if anybody has any questions about this as well, that if you just Google some of this information, you'll come up with this great website that I mentioned earlier tonight. And if anybody has any questions about that, you can always reach me on the show or email me at Reenie, R-E-E-N-I-E, Brewer, B-R-E-W-E-R, 91 at gmail.com. So thank you, Shell, and I will hopefully hear from you tomorrow night, and I know you're going away this weekend, so we'll tell everybody what you're doing tomorrow night. Okay, so everybody, from my heart to yours, this is Renee, and good night and God bless. Good night, Shell.
Good night, Renee. Good night, everyone.